Okay, so our topic for the next couple of weeks, short people in deep water. What does it feel like when we're in over our heads? So I have some very specific topics that in the next couple of weeks we're going to talk about, specific instances in life. Today we're just going to do a general overview. So if you have a Bible and you'd like to follow along with this, I'm going to start over in the Gospel of John, the 16th chapter. Now, these are some well-known words of Jesus. We often cite these couple of verses whenever someone is going through some difficulty. I don't know that they're necessarily the best to describe our personal deep water experiences, but Jesus describes a general condition that humans face. So I'm going to start here with the 32nd verse. Behold, the hour is coming, indeed it has come, when you will be scattered, each to his own home, and will leave me alone. Yet I am not alone, for the Father is with me. So principle number one, Jesus already aware that what's facing him, and he says, every one of you is going to essentially forsake me for at least a short period of time. I'm going to be alone. But what is his immediate response? I am not really alone. The Father is with me. Is aloneness not one of the most difficult experiences that you face when you're going through tough times? I'm scared. I'm nervous. I'm feeling insecure or inadequate. No one understands me, and no one can help. And frankly, when desperation sets in, we don't even care if anybody understands us. We just like to know that somebody can help. Make the problem go away. I don't care if you understand my problem. I don't care if you understand what I'm feeling like. But could you just make the problem go away? Yet I'm not alone, for the Father is with me, he says. I have said these things to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation. But take heart, I have overcome the world. What do you want when tribulation comes your way?
Hope.
That's a good answer. Hope. Did somebody say a solution? Yeah, that's really what we want, isn't it? And honestly, when we get right down to it, we
want somebody to fix it.
Yes, well, that's a solution. So when Jesus says, I've come to give you peace, is that a solution? It's like, here's what we want, and it's coming toward God in one direction, and here is God sending us something different. And it's like, no, I don't really want that. I want the problem to go away. So here is the underlying thing, and it's why we start out with this verse. We would like to go through life, avoid problems, and remain who we are. God says to us instead, the world you live in is going to be filled with difficulties, challenges. And let's pause right there. Have you ever had something good come into your life through a challenge? Well, not only does it happen, the way in which you worded it made it sound almost as if that's a rarity, or it could happen. How many really good things come to us when we're in deep water? Have you ever started a new job? Have you ever started a new job that you knew nothing about, and you were not sure if you could manage the job? Gotten into a new relationship and weren't sure if you were right for that? Gotten married and weren't sure if you knew what to do about that? What's that?
That didn't work out well.
That didn't work out well.
You got two big kids.
So here is the message of God. Our hope is, God, please make the world small enough for our small selves. God says, I want to make you big enough for the problems in the world. I want to grow you into someone who, with my help, is able to manage life. Our cry is, just make the world small enough so that we can handle it. Those are two completely different things. I know I've used this example before, but it's fitting right now again. There's an author, Scott Peck, The Road Less Traveled book. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of it. The key principal item in the book, he says, and he was a psychologist. He did both clinical work and research work. And he said, people that he met with consistently, and people would come to him for several years' time or more. Some came for a period of 10 years or so. And he said, the people that got on the best in life were the people that understood or came to understand that life is difficult. So that when a new situation came into their lives, they weren't shocked. We all know people that ask the why me question. When something bad happens in their life and they say, why me? Something difficult happens, why me? And he said, in my practice, the people that I observed that were able to best manage life were the people that didn't continue to question, why me? When difficulty came into their life, they said, oh, that's not a surprise. That's the way life works. Life is difficult, so I'm not surprised. Have you learned that life is not going to be easy? And that's not a trick question, because I think there's people that go through... I know people that are in their 40s yet, and they whine because life is not what they expected it to be. So let's come back to this foundational principle. It is God's intention to grow us into people that are big enough to meet the world head on, not God's objective to reduce the world to something that is manageable for us.
Is it safe to say that challenges force you to become a bigger, better person?
What do you think?
Yeah. I think anybody that whines about a challenge is a whiner. You know what I mean? Like, you probably haven't had enough challenges in your life to step over to become that better person.
Well, people who take the road less traveled don't live in fear. Because the road less traveled is less traveled. That's a dark, lonely road at night. And they're not afraid of it. Well, why? I've done this before. I told my wife, I mean, she kids me about being lost. I said, I'm not lost. I haven't hit water yet. Then I'm lost. You know what I mean? Because I don't live like that. I don't live in that fear of what might come down the road. You know, it's funny. I haven't looked at anything like this for a long time, but they were just talking about this whole, like, solar flare thing that was going on and some sort of thing. And I, for whatever reason, saw a picture of the Earth in a very close proximity to the sun. If the Earth fell into the sun, it would go splash.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. The Earth. You know what I mean?
We're actually going to come back to that basic idea in just a moment.
Okay.
All right. I'd like to turn over to a verse in Colossians for a minute, and then we're going to project that back onto this verse that we just looked at in John. Colossians 3, this is a verse that we looked at a little while ago during the one and others. And it is verse 15, and let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called. Let the peace of Christ govern, have reign, have control, be the preeminent, dominant thing that influences your inner disposition. I don't know if I can say it any more clearly.
That's a verse that I've used a lot, and you probably heard me say, and the root of that is really act as an umpire in your life, keeping your life in control, on track, not in the chaos.
All right, now, I'd like us to go back to that setting where we read the verses that Jesus is talking to his followers. He's in some of his last hours on earth. He has a good understanding of what's facing him. The guys that he's talking to really don't. Now just think about this for a minute. Who has reason to not have peace? Can you imagine if those guys really at that moment understood what was going to happen in the next 12 hours? What would be their mental disposition right then and there? Here's a different question. Would they even be in the room if they knew what was going to happen 12 hours from now? They would have been doing everything possible to get out of town and probably take Jesus with them. You can't do this. You shouldn't do this. So here is the one individual in the room who really does understand, and he's at peace and still offering counsel and wisdom to the people in the room who don't understand, and if they actually did, would have anything but peace at that moment. Somebody had a hand up over here.
I think eventually they all did. Eventually they all came to their own suffering. And at one point, I guess, they lined them up. You know what I mean? And each one had to watch the other one take a beating. And they still kept going. I mean, eventually they learned to do that.
Eventually, we can learn to do that. Eventually, they did. But that peace was not in their hearts. That confidence was not in their hearts yet.
Wasn't Jesus always like that? That's, well, he was like cool as a cucumber.
Well, of course he is going to be cool because... Why?
Because he knows.
Because his Father is with him. And he has a confident assurance of that. You've had a week to live. In the last week, since we met last, how many times have you had opportunity to be nervous, to doubt, to be scared? For some of you, it hasn't been that much. So that's another one of these realities, and it's the first principle. We're going to look at some ground rules here for when you're in over your head, and the first one is, you really don't know when you're in over your head until you are. And for some of us, it comes on quickly. Very quickly. I mean, I don't want to be morbid here, but any one of us could leave this room today and within 24 hours, our mate could be gone. One of our children could die. I mean, I know this sounds depressing and all that, but that's the reality of life.
It happens.
It does.
My sister died New Year's Day. Her older sister, 20 months older. 1 month ago, they told her, you have cancer. New Year's Day, she's dead.
Woman who works for us, has a sister, lives in Northern Virginia. The sister came into work one day. The owner of the company had embezzled most of the money. The company was closed. Just like that. No job. I mean, literally, just like that. Walk in. There is no job today. No warning. No advanced trouble signs. No nothing. She lives in what is probably one of the most expensive counties in the country to live in. What would it feel like if you lost your high-paying job in a high-paying location where you had a very expensive mortgage and everything cost a lot of money? Just like that, it happens. Absolutely no one knows when the next deep water moment is for us. All right. Let's go through a couple of these rules that I'm calling them for living out of your depth. The first is, you have no idea when your next deep water moment will be. And you won't know until you are. The second one we've already talked about, no one would choose to go through a difficult time. Think about your 20-year-old self. You hadn't quite gone through as many difficulties as you have now. What did your 20-year-old self worry about? What was the biggest problem that you were concerned? I mean, you were scared to death of it, nervous. Couldn't imagine how you would cope with it.
Girlfriend problem.
Okay. Well, given who you are, I understand that. But but that was a major problem, right?
Little things. When you're up on it, it's like this. When you look back at things, there's little tiny bumps.
The reality is we'd all like to think that we've aged and we've been through so many challenges and difficulties that now our problems are all really big.
Well,
I wonder if that's true.
Different things are harder problems for different people. Some people, the thought of living without money absolutely puts them into a paralyzing fear. The thought of being broke. Mm-hmm. I've lived broke. I've lived on literally dollars a week. I know how to do it. I've done it before. I've been there. So that doesn't put me into a paralyzing fear. That doesn't. I've been divorced twice. Losing a wife doesn't put me into a paralyzing fear. You know?
I'm sure Barb would be comforted to know that. I've lost wives before.
I would,
one up, one down. Yeah, I've been there before.
I would be gut-wrenchingly sad for a period. And then I have to get over it. Just like I always have. That's, you know, and it's funny because you talk about this deep water thing. I've done that. As a child. I could swim underwater, but I couldn't swim on top of the water, so I'm swimming in the pool. End up in 8 feet of water. My mistake.
Mm-hmm.
My cousin was not standing on the edge of the pool. I'm not sitting here. He knew how to swim. It was just one of those things. If there wasn't somebody there, and I think we all have that person in our lives. We all have that one person that we call when the chips are down. There's one person. Man, I gotta call so-and-so. And at least I'm... Yeah, I would think that if I probably looked at almost everybody in this room, there's somebody that could get a call. See, dude, you know what? My wife just left. No warning. My job just went away. No warning. I don't know what to do.
That's one of the benefits that we're going to get to in a little bit. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. Randall, I'm going to borrow your words from last week. I hope you don't mind. After the study is over last week, I'm having a couple of words of conversation with Randall, and this is very applicable to what we just talked about. That we think that we arrive at a stage where things won't rattle us, or things won't shake us, or things aren't difficult. So here's Randall, and we're talking about Moses' seasons of life and the difficulties that he's got to go through. And he says, you know, I've been through all these seasons of my life and all these challenges and all these things that I've had to go through. And he said to me, and he's just he and I, straight on, eye to eye contact. And he says, and this is the most difficult transition. This is the most difficult season of my life. Now, I'm not going to get into all the details of how you find yourself, where you are, and the message that we all need to hear about that is, there's no such place that you arrive on an island of bliss where it's all going to be okay from that moment on. Your next deep water moment may start tomorrow. Quince.
And isn't that because, if you think about it, these trials and these tribulations are designed by them? Because we're ever evolving in an ultimate relationship that is to have a relationship with them, to rely totally and wholly on them. We have to have, you know, like a lot of things, the first thing you should do is go to the throne and then to the throne and so forth, because you have to have earthly connections and things like that. But is it ultimately designed for you to keep evolving with a close relationship with them and intimate?
I believe God uses the things. I don't want to say that everything is necessarily designed.
Yeah, that might be too strong.
I mean, I think, for instance, if my wife were to die today, I would have a hard time saying God designed it that way to draw me closer to Him.
Right.
God can use that as a vehicle to draw me closer to Him, to place more confidence in Him.
Right.
And I want to remove this from this...
Can you say that differently, in that God designed pain to move me closer?
No, just understanding that maybe pain in the night of joy comes in the morning, because you understand that it is His ultimate design, and for us He has nothing but good. So
the Apostle Paul said, we live this life by faith. Mm-hmm. The life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith. This is a faith walk in this. Trusting. Keep placing confidence in. because we're going to continually face situations until we stop breathing here.
Mm-hmm. And I want you to hold that idea, that faith idea, because that is...
Pain is designed that way, though. Pain is designed to move us away from that danger, that thing, that fear, that is designed to move us kind of like, I'm going to distance myself from that. But if I lack faith, I'm still going to live in it, and I'm not going to get that peace that you're talking about.
Because Satan will use it as a temptation, and it's just a test. God doesn't tempt us, but Satan wants to be a temptation where we stop or lessen our faith in God, our trust in God.
All right. While I continue on with my points here, if you would like to turn over to Exodus, just go to the 16th chapter, the beginning of the 16th chapter. All right, so we rarely choose to go beyond our own comfort or our own depth. Point number three, touching bottom does not mean you're in control. We have all these illusions of being in control when we're really not. Now, I just want you to think about how frail and how fragile our overall existence is. And you talked about us being the little orb that's spinning around the sun. You know, there's only a few miles of atmosphere that separate us from death. I mean, really, just think about that. Yeah, and the lowest couple are pretty darn important. Really important. A couple of miles of air are the only thing between us and annihilation. How often do you think about that? If you live in New York City, you're a week and a half away from starvation at any given time. Because if something happened so that the normal food supply chain was broken, millions of people would probably starve to death for a lack of the ability to get food and fresh water. Yeah. Our entire country's food supply is based on a series of things that teeters on the edge at all times, and none of us thinks about it.
Except the doomsday preppers. They think about it.
Okay. If you watch the doomsday people on the Discovery Channel, then you know that. But they're a little over the edge the other way.
Well, yeah. Well, but they're ready for whatever's coming.
How much do we really believe that we are in control? I want you to think about that. This country provides us with a tremendous opportunity to live in our own strength. You lose your job, what happens? There's a safety net to catch you. It's not as comfortable as it was. You will drop lower to the ground. There may be a bounce factor when you hit the net. It may be scary, but you're caught. You're going to eat. There's all these things that provide for us. I don't want to say there's no homeless people in this country that aren't homeless by choice, because there are some that aren't. But for most people in this country, it is possible to live and never give a thought to God. Never give a thought to their total dependency on things that they have no control over. Here's another one. Do you spend a lot of time worrying about whether you're in control? Making sure that the dominoes of your life are lined up so that they can't fall? So I put a little something here. You don't?
Most people.
Okay, look at the contradiction here. I'm really not in control. Yet I am going to obsess over being in control. I can't be in control. Everything in all of nature teaches me that I really am not in control, yet I will do everything in my power to build an environment for myself where I am ultimately the master of that environment and I am in control and nothing bad can happen to me. And the funny thing is, you and I have both of those practices in place in our lives regularly. Talk about schizophrenic. We really are. Part of us understands that we're not in control, although we never visit that part of our life. The other part of us strives desperately to make sure that from cradle to grave, we are in control and we have a perfect environment.
But it usually takes somebody outside of us to say, you're not in control.
Or we find ourselves in an in over our head moment. Now, is this not true for us? What do we learn from the in over our head moment? That the faster we can get back to dry land and be back in control of our lives, the better we are, right? That was a bad experience, and we learned the wrong lesson. We don't learn what John said is faith. It is hard to walk by faith. So let's take a look at the Exodus thing. I'm going to pause on my list here for a moment. We're actually going to back up into the 15th chapter, and we're going to start there. So the people have no water. We're going to start at the 23rd verse. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. Therefore, it was named Marah. And the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Now notice the response here. The people complained to who?
Moses.
"Dan, I don't have any water to drink. What do you want me to do?"
"Yes."
"You brought us out here. You fix it."
Right. There's a complete disconnect here. Now, what is Moses' immediate response? "And he cried to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a log, and he threw it into the water, and the water became sweet." The people complain to a person. The one person that has confidence in God goes to God. The word here is grumbled. Does anybody have any different words there? It says the people grumbled against Moses. Okay. Complained. There's a phenomenon that takes place here. And it gets back to what Jim was talking about with people. When do you grumble the most? When you can be with the, in the presence of other grumblers. There is nothing to get a good grumble and gripe fest going like being in the presence of a few other grumblers and gripers, because the two of you or the three of you or the dozen of you together, you bring diversity to the conversation. So, suppose, Clark, you forgot part of what you could have grumbled about. Right? You didn't have the full picture of the necessity for grumbling and all the aspects of this issue that could be grumbled about. Right? There's Jim over here, and Jim has nuanced grumbling to a science. I mean, he knows those points. And so you feed off of each other. And you're laughing. Tell me this doesn't happen. Tell me this doesn't happen in a workplace. Or, if you're a parent, the only time when all of your kids will agree on anything is when they come together to agree to grumble about you, the parent. It's guaranteed to unite them.
You can cut off their food supply.
They call that a meeting.
All right. So God gives them something. And here's the thing. The people grumble to Moses. Moses responds by petitioning God. The people have an opportunity to watch this. What do they learn? They've learned the wrong lesson. Then they set out, they camp at this oasis spot for a while, and then they set out from Elam. And all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elam and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. So they're about 40 days out now from the time that they left. And the whole congregation of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. You know, when we repeat this story again and again and we talk about how often the people grumble, there's a reason why we talk about how often the people grumble. Because the text says the people grumble an awful lot. At every occasion when there is the opportunity for them to trust or to complain, their go-to default response is complain. Okay, and so we'll read their complaint. Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. All right. So this whole episode of grumbling goes on, and God says, I'm going to provide for their needs. And so we go down to the 16th verse now. This is what the Lord has commanded. This is Moses talking to the people. He's decided to give them this manna. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, each of you, as much as he can eat. You shall take an omer, according to the number of the persons that each of you has in his tent. And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more and some less, but when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered a little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as they could eat. And Moses said to them, let no one leave any of it over till the morning. In other words, there's going to be enough for every day. Don't hoard it. Don't try to save it. Have confidence that I am going to provide more of it tomorrow. What's your immediate response to that? What's that? Thank you? Thank you, but I think I'll keep some for tomorrow?
No, thank you for providing it today.
No, that's all. I don't want to have to go out tomorrow and work.
Or, I'll believe you, but I, okay, so out of a tribe here we are, we represent the tribe, right? We have one thankful guy. I haven't taken account here this morning, but the rest of us are doubters and grumblers. You're thankful.
Absolutely.
And you're going to go out the next day and look for it because you're not going to hoard any.
I don't show up. The Lord will provide.
Okay.
That's the way it works.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right, there's two of you, just like there was Caleb and Joshua, right? The rest of us are grumblers.
You know what I mean? When you look at this, they're not even 3 months into this ordeal, and they're already complaining. How long were they traveling?
Okay, well...
they were complaining right away.
Let's keep something in mind here. They don't know it's an ordeal yet. They don't know it's going to be for the rest of their lives yet.
No, that's what I mean. That's the really funny part about this whole thing. They're not even 3 months into what we know is going to be death in the desert. Like, you guys are going to flounder. And you're complaining already. If I'm Moses, I'm going, if you guys don't shut up, I'm out of here. I'll go take my chances on my own.
But every day he provides for them food, right?
Yeah.
So after the first day or the second day, what are you crying about? Every day he provides you with food, so wouldn't he get tired of hearing yourself complain?
It's the same food every day.
Who cares? I eat the same food every day too. I don't care. You know, I don't complain. It fills my belly and I'm good.
Lord.
But wouldn't you... what are they complaining about?
Because they can. That's literally what he's talking
what
about.
What happens when grumblers get together?
I walk away because I'm annoyed because I heard the same thing yesterday.
Okay, so now we have three people. We have two thankful people and somebody who has trust.
God's teaching Moses that he's in over his head. That he doesn't see the trouble he's going to have. His people are going to go crazy. Are going crazy. He wouldn't choose this. All your points. Moses is the one in the middle of the tribulation. These people think food's a problem. He's got a problem. He's trying to be the intermediary and manage this. He's trying to show them God's going to be good to us. No way.
Yeah. Yeah, but we
this is about a million people or so. This is about a million people or so.
Yeah.
Should have been 11 or 14 days. That was should have been the trip. Here it is. They're into the unknown. All they know was they were slaves back in Egypt.
And they're basically listening to another human being.
Mm-hmm.
We see that they're not listening to God. They don't hear from God. Moses hears it from God. Moses is telling them, so now that's like hearsay. You know, that's like going to work and your boss tell you, don't worry about it. You know you're going to, you know, so yeah, you probably keep, you know, who's Moses, you know what I mean? You're believing in one other guy that the food is going to come tomorrow.
Okay, so you're introducing another important point. Are there other responses that we can have? Because we do grumble. Wow, I need like a sun visor now, right? Huh?
You have to go the other way.
Yeah, that's okay.
It's not far over there. You'll be at UC.
Okay, fine. If it bothers you that much, I'll move. There.
There you go.
Okay. Are there other responses besides grumbling? What produces grumbling? Fear? Doubt? Worry?
Lack? Regret.
Okay. So are there, apparently there's plenty of things that produce grumbling. Are there other responses? This is a very personal question. If you have learned to grumble, I believe grumbling is learned. You can improve it. You can perfect it. You can become a master of it as the years pass by. I truly believe that. You can start out as an amateur grumbler in your 20s and become a master of it by the time you're in your 50s.
Plus, out of a million people, you're going to have a few in there that want to see Moses fail.
Yeah.
So they're the ones that are starting everything against
him. And I don't even know that they necessarily think that Moses is going to fail, but they definitely think that they can do a better job.
Right. Plus, I mean, they want to try to make him look like he's going to. They want to make him.
You don't
fail.
Have any idea what you're doing. I could do that. I could do that.
But then you see, they're all.
And the truth is, sometimes they're going to be right. Moses doesn't always know what he's doing. It doesn't matter if Moses always knows what he's doing.
Right.
Moses is remaining in touch with God and open to God's direction.
Because Moses never thought to do what he was doing.
Right.
Yeah, he's on his journey too.
And just like Brian said, who would pick this job? Yeah, pick me to take a million people out into the desert. I want that job.
Well, even Moses said, I can't do this.
Right.
Do what you're asking. What
job? Well, Moses didn't want it from the beginning. You know, he's the one that said he can't talk, he can't do this, he can't go against Pharaoh, he can't do anything.
Quince, to give your hand up?
Yeah, I was just thinking, so, in essence, with all, all those goodies,
back
there you go. With all those goodies of people, and all the diversity and everything that's coming at Moses, the main issue of that is Moses speaking to God, God basically telling them, you don't know, but if you stay connected with me, you'll be all right. So that's the that relationship that they were building and the trust that Moses, we heard from God, if you just keep listening to me, I have this. You just do as I say. Don't worry about all that stuff. It'll be all right.
Okay. Now, here's what I want to do before we lose track of the purpose to this, because it's great to talk theory. It's great to trash the disciples because they're idiots, morons, and don't know anything. It's great to trash the people in the desert because they don't know anything. How comfortable is each of us with living with the uncertainty of tomorrow and simply going through life one day at a time in trust? Be honest. Now, I know when you're reduced to there is no other option, there is no other option. It's either do it or not. It's either be a nervous wreck all the time. Have you been at that point where you live hour by hour as a nervous wreck because you're afraid of what's going to happen next? So we all know what that feels like, or many of us know what that feels like. To be scared, to have no confidence, to doubt God, and to have to live moment by moment in nothing but your own atmosphere of worry. But can we live beyond that? Can we come to the point that we can, and this comes back to what Jesus said, I haven't come to make the problem go away. I have come to fill you with a sense of inner peace and tranquility that will allow you to go through this desert of difficulty.
Yeah, but there's a scripture that says that first of all, suffering is required, that after suffering comes perseverance. If you come to that place where you're in deep water and you're going through tribulation and you persevere through it, then you'll get some character. You'll come to that place where you have faith because you've been through a few things. But you don't get hope until after the character. Hope comes last. Hope only comes when you've been through a few things and you can say, I have hope. Why? Oh, because he brought me through more than one thing in my life. You're right. My first day clean, I was panicked. Absolutely panicked. And I've been through some stuff in my life to that point. But I could just let go of everything, every illusion that ever, and said, you know what, I'm going to do this instead. I was panicked. 25 years later, it's nothing. Knock down my house. Crash my car. God forbid, take my wife. God forbid, take my wife. It'll be all right. I might not like it. I'll be uncomfortable for a minute. I will. I'll be uncomfortable for a minute.
Jason.
I don't agree 100% with that, because I've been that day to day, that hour to hour, minute to minute, and then I just recently failed, and I'm back in square one. I built, I had character, I indulged, and right now everything's in shambles. So when you say, you know, I've been through this, anything can happen, I had that thought and that way of living, you know, just a little while ago, that anything can happen. I've already been brought up out of the dirt, saying I'm happy. But then when you indulge in self-will, and you fail, and you let your own old way of thinking bring you back down a few pegs to where you used to be, careless, reckless, and just don't care, then you turn around and you say, why am I going through this? How could I fail you again? So it's easy to live your life thinking that if anything happens, it's fine, I'm safe, until that happens. Once that happens, how did I let this happen? Why did I let this? Why did we let this? You know, you don't know where to turn to. So, you know, and then being in that rebuilding phase,
but you learn though.
Yeah, but here, yeah, that's
what I'm saying. Look what you're saying.
Yeah.
You look at your character now. And you're stronger today than you were.
And the next time you don't put yourself in that position. The next time you don't put yourself in that position where this close is too close. Or where, you know, I'm over here and I could go to North Philly, not for nothing.
We're actually going to come to that in a moment. So if we can not over talk that now, we're going to come back to that. Because what Jason is saying, let's just distill this down to a simple phrase that we can all get. No matter what the specifics of the situation.
Yeah, no matter what.
I might be able to trust God with the situations in my life where I didn't bring my own calamity on. But can I trust God when I am the deliverer of my own calamity? Can I trust God when I am my own worst enemy? Does God become my enemy when I become my enemy? That's the question. Well, you can say no on the far side of the desert, having gone through many desert experiences. This is not a question that any man can answer satisfactorily for another man. All we can do is give people some reasonable hope that there are people who have walked the desert and made it to the other side. You understand? My story doesn't guarantee your success. All it does is say that God has been faithful to me. But each of us has to live through our own doubts, our concerns, our fears.
Yeah, if you're stuck in the middle of the desert, you don't know if anybody made it to the other side. So you know, it always looks bad from there on.
But that's why this happens, though. I said you need somebody who's been on the other side. Says, don't worry, it's just over that hill. Don't panic.
But I mean, in life, there's always a desert. That you think you're the first one in that desert. And there is, you don't know if anybody ever made it to the other side from that desert. And I mean, there's always a fear.
Let me pause for a moment right there with what you're saying, because I need to say something. When you're in the middle of the desert, you're not going to be able to find the help. Sometimes the help needs to come to you. For those of us who are not in the middle of an in-over-our-heads experience at the moment, for those of us who are on solid ground and at this moment we're doing well, as brothers walking through life together, it's our job to be watching out for the people who are in the middle of a desert experience. You understand what I'm saying? The guy who's weak, who's down, who's out, he doesn't necessarily have enough energy to go reach out for help. The guy that this Samaritan finds on the side of the road, he doesn't stand up, go over and flag down the Samaritan and say, yo, I need help. The Samaritan comes to him.
But is there truly any, in today's, right now, is there truly any situation that nobody has ever, is there a desert that nobody has an experience?
No.
No. Like,
there is a footprint on every part of this planet. There's nowhere that nobody hasn't visited.
Right. But when you're in the crowd, though, you don't think about the other person.
Church, I'm going to go to you. I want to know someone who's driving these parents. I want to go to date. Like, there's any way you turn, there's somebody that's going through it already. Right. There's no excuse to sit there and say,
what happens is we're in our desert, we own it, we buy it, and the thought is nobody has been where I've been before. That's the deception of life, where the enemy wants us to be isolated out there.
Or
my desert.
It's not even necessarily only that we think that we're the first person, the only person who has or ever will. Have you ever been in your desert and been embarrassed by the fact that, oh, here I am. The last thing I want to do is go tell anybody that I found my way into the desert.
Guilt and shame.
And pride.
That is the only reason you're in the desert. That you're still in the desert. Guilt, shame, pride, embarrassment. That's the only reason you're still in the desert.
Well, you may have to go through the desert, but you don't have to go through the desert alone. All right.
Guess what? That the whole entire thing you're talking about this morning is, that was your lead-off verse, is loneliness. You're alone because you choose to be. We live in the year 2013. You're alone because you choose to be. Now, don't get me wrong. I've lived there. I've isolated myself, and I've done that. I've pulled back, and we talked about this before. Sometimes on my own, sometimes not necessarily. Sometimes for a good reason, but sometimes not necessarily for a good reason. You know what I mean? Like, I've lived on both sides of that.
Okay. Well, so we've talked about my shame. My guilt may keep me away from other people. My lack of understanding of who might be able to help me may keep me away from other people. But there's another really honest reality here. I'm meeting with a guy every couple of weeks right now who's going through some, we'll call it challenging financial stuff. He feels alone a lot of the time merely because he's reasonably confident that nobody else really understands his emotional circumstances, understands the problem, gets the difficulty, gets the challenge of what he's going through. He knows his wife doesn't. He knows that most of the people in his office don't. And I'm meeting with a guy, and here are the words that I think sometimes people need to hear. It's like the fact that you find yourself... Well, here, I'm just going to read the words right from point number 6 here of some ground rules. Your problems are not, number 1, proof that God is angry with you. Your problems are not proof that you deserve punishment. You're shaking your head, but have you ever questioned that? Have you ever thought to yourself... And that's when we really get alone. When I am so alone that I think that God is now my enemy, then I'm truly isolated.
What do you think? I mean, what do you think the people, the followers of Moses, they felt exactly that? I'm sure that's why they went to Moses. I mean, that's why they didn't go to God. That's why they went to Moses.
They grumbled because of expectation.
And is anybody ever out of that desert? Your life from? I mean, are you ever out of that struggle? No matter what it is. I mean, you wake up in the morning and struggle. I've never met a person that doesn't have something going on that's a struggle. It isn't a struggle. Whether they want to admit it or not. You got stuff during the day and evening or whatever that
I don't disagree with you. Again, we're going to come back to some more stuff that I think is going to answer some of this real quick, Quince.
That's what the lead off, like you said, and when you're in those stuff, that's why it's careful to be careful who you surround yourself with during those times.
Okay, so suppose you're new.
Okay.
So suppose you're new to this whole thing. Who have you surrounded yourself with for the past 20 years?
Right.
Think about that. Who have you surrounded yourself with for the past 10, 15, 20 years when things are difficult? Who do you go to? Maybe if they're part of the problem, but you don't know who else to surround yourself with. All right. Two more points. Your problems are not an indication that God has abandoned you. Have you ever doubted that? Where are you? Why aren't you doing anything? And finally, an unusual occurrence which is unique to you. All right. I want to come back to Exodus for a minute. So we're going to come back to God's instruction to Moses. Now remember, this manna is not supposed to last. On the sixth day, it will last for the seventh. So they've got a day's provision, except for the fact that, this is amazing. Let's actually come back and look at this for a minute. Verse number 27. On the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather and they found none, meaning of the manna. And the Lord said to Moses, "How long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. Remain, each of you, in his place. Let no one go out of his place on the seventh day." So the people rested on the seventh day. Can you rest from your own struggle? Just be honest. Can you rest from your own struggle?
It's tough to turn that off,
isn't it? Do you understand the gift that God is giving them here? They don't understand the gift that God is giving them. They want to be out there. They want to go get this stuff. They're preoccupied with it. They want to collect it. They want to do something with it. They can't rest in God's provision. And don't minimize this and don't turn this into a trite church kind of a lesson. Can you honestly relax in God's provision for your life? Can you honestly relax to the extent that you don't need to be flipping the switches and pulling the strings of your life every moment of every day? Can you trust that God's going to take care of you?
I didn't used to.
It's really tough, isn't it? This is the gift that God is promising us, a Sabbath rest. I am going to care for you. You can rest. You need the rest. This is not about do you mow your grass on Sunday, okay? Please, let's not turn the Sabbath into some stupid legalistic nonsense. This is, can you lay the burdens of your life in God's hands for a time because you need emotional refreshment?
Doesn't that piggyback on what you just said earlier? That's realizing it's actually in control.
So your ability to implement any kind of Sabbath, and remember the way we described it, an ability to lay your burdens in God's hands and let Him carry them. We say that that is a component of Sabbath. Your ability to do that is a good indicator of your trust in God. Not what you say, but what you actually believe. I have to tell you, I'm not very good at Sabbath. Okay? I got to tell you, I got to keep at least one finger on a switch 24/7. I'm really bad at it. Now, I know I shouldn't say that because that doesn't sound like the right thing to tell you, but it's just who I am.
I think we all do that to a certain degree. You know what I mean? My finger might not be on the switch, the little red button, but the key is hanging around my neck. And it's all falling. You know what I mean? I'm going to have it available. And I think that too. It's available. If you want to worry, I tell people this in recovery. If you want to worry, go ahead. Go ahead. Let me know how that works out for you. It doesn't change your circumstance. It doesn't change where you're at. It doesn't change your thing, you know. And we talked about this just the other week. So oftentimes, I'm where I'm at. I'm overwhelmed. I'm in over my head because I've behaved my way into something. Not because God brought me there, but because of my own self-will. I self-willed my way into a corner. Now I want to yell at God and blame Him that He brought me here. I did not. You never asked me where to go. You never asked me. You thought you knew what you were doing. I said, okay, fine. I'm God. I can't mess with your choice. I can try to keep you safe while you're making these unhealthy decisions for yourself. But at some point, when you come back, I'll still be here. And you will come back.
Okay. Moving forward in Exodus, 33rd verse. And Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout all generations. Now that seems like kind of a peculiar sort of a thing to do. In the middle of just trying to survive, in the middle of depending on God a day at a time, what are you thinking about? Are you thinking about 40 years from now? Are you thinking about 100 years from now? What are you thinking about tomorrow?
2 minutes. The next 2 minutes.
We're consumed, right? We're consumed with what's going to happen to us tomorrow. And at that very moment, God's instruction to his leaders is, I want you to take some of this daily provision and I want you to set it aside. You don't need to turn here, but I'm going to read from Joshua. They're ready to go in and finally, years later, take possession of the land. And the manna ceased the day after they ate the produce of the land. And there was no longer manna for the people of Israel. But they ate of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. How long will it take for you to forget God's daily provision when God's daily provision vanishes the next day? If God provides for you a day at a time, and tomorrow yesterday's evidence of provision is vanished and it's gone, and the only place that it could be is in your memory, how long will it be when you're back on your feet before the memory of God's provision in your past difficulty starts to dim?
I think the first day that man is not there, they panic.
Well, they've got other food. They're back on their feet.
All of a sudden, God's provision is not there, and they know that that tree could burn up at any minute, that there could be a drought. They understand drought. They understand all of that stuff. They understand the drought happens, and sometimes food's not hanging from the trees. But now, it's not just laying in my front yard.
I'm going to push back on that. Have you ever been, I don't have, I'm nervous, and then you get a new job? Don't worry, God, I got it from here. Now, be honest. Don't worry, God, I got it from here. I think we're all good now. Thanks for your help in the past, but I think I got it under control now. How long does it take, honestly, before God's past provision is just a memory and you're not even sure? And then, here's the next thing. Is that really God? Or did I just make that up when I was there in the middle of it?
That's a choice, though. That's a choice.
I want to act. I want to be able to, you know, pick it up and carry it and take care of everything myself. That's the illusion of the world. You got to be a man. God helps those who help themselves. It's not impossible. You know, it's not the way it is. But
it's not that truth is totally, we can push so far back against that. The people did have to go out every day and gather the manna. The manna didn't come to the people. The people had to go to the manna. There is a dual reality there.
I know, but after so, go ahead.
We're quick to forget God. You know, what does it say? It says, don't let me starve so that I go and steal the strength.
Yes.
Don't let me have too much that I forget.
We're actually going to look at that verse in another week or two.
But again, that's...
There we are.
I think the enemy brings such distraction upon us. Just brings such distraction. I mean, don't forget, he is awesome at that. Awesome at that.
Well, that was the reason for these feasts and festivals, the Passover, so they would remember and not forget, because we tend to forget so quickly.
But I think that's why, like, I have those things around my house. I keep things.
Give all of us a few example, a few, okay? A few examples of some things that you keep around your house.
I have, books that I write in. Barbara and I actually, if you've ever seen the movie The Notebook, Barbara and I started to keep one of those. Because I know there's going to come a time in my life when I'm in the desert of my life and I won't remember how faithful he has been in my life. I just won't be able to do it. My brain will no longer be able to function in the capacity that it does now or that it has in the past. And so we write those things down. I've told people that before. There was a year when you guys gave out rocks, stones. We still have that one. Gave those out to as a significant. When God shows up in your life significantly, put down an altar. Put something down. Put something in the living room that says, he showed up here. He showed up here. That way when people come in and go, what's that? I thought it was over, but...
Incidentally, those were good things. I don't remember the stone one, but one week I remember ending up with a Lego in my pocket. Do you give Legos out for something? I can't remember what that... Those were good things. You should return to doing that once in a while.
But again, that's... You know what I mean? We do forget because we let ourselves forget. You know?
That's why pictures are important. That's why we have...
Absolutely.
Pictures. That's why we had a Built for Life brochure, a campaign, a folder. All remembrances, memorials, keeping us on track and focus. Those are all helps.
So I hope you heard Jim. That's why I wanted you to share that with people, and I wanted it to come from somebody besides me. Keep something to remember the difficult times and God's provision by. Something that is going to be significant to you. Because the next thing that you worry about is going to seem bigger than the last thing that you worried about. And maybe it will be, because you'll be a bigger person. And it will seem more overwhelming, perhaps. And the probability that you are going to diminish the miraculous increases with time. The further away you are from the miracle that God performed in your past, the less it feels like a miracle, and the more it feels like circumstance. I'll just tell you that right now. If you haven't experienced that personally...
Gideon fell. Oh, you have too many. What? What do you mean I have too many? Nah, you'll boast and think that it's you, that somehow you guys did it. Get rid of these guys. You know what I mean? And, in the end, God handled it.
All right, we're going to take some time, probably in a future week, to unpack this. But because of what Jason was talking about, I definitely want to go over to this Romans text and read this. So if you'd like to follow along here, this to me has been a powerful text of Scripture. Romans 8, we're going to start at the 31st verse. What then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things? Who shall bring any charge against God's elect? It is God who justifies. Who is to condemn? Well, just think of all the people who might condemn. All the people who might criticize, all the people who might say, you're worthy of this difficult time that you're going through. And when we read this, we tend to think of ourselves as outside of that. Do you ever condemn yourself?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Right, and when you condemn yourself, you live with your condemner 24 hours a day.
Yes, I am my own worst critic.
Who is to condemn? Think about that. Christ Jesus is the one who died. More than that, who was raised. Who is at the right hand of God. Who indeed is interceding for us. So here's what Paul is saying before we move on. The God whom you might question has already given up his Son on our behalf. He's already made this huge investment in our well-being. Now, if he has already invested this much, it's like this. Would you spend $500,000 to take out a mortgage on a house that's worth $500,000 and then light it on fire? Think about the absurdity of that. Would God invest His Son in our lives only to watch us self-destruct? He who has already given up His own Son, will He not then follow through on that investment? He's the one who's made the investment. He has a lot to lose here. We tend to not appreciate that, not see that. Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? And we could take some time to unpack each of them and think about what they represent. But there's all these things, and every time we get into a difficult situation, is God angry with us? Do I deserve this? All these recriminating questions, doubts.
And it's good to take an inventory and to evaluate our life and how we got to where we're at. But if we're not careful, that's where we tend to go and stay there. But it always isn't the case at all. And if it is the case, I made wrong choices. I failed. I made wrong decisions. Is he against me? Is he abandoned me? Is
no.
He going to stop loving me? No.
No, he is not.
Right. He wants to redeem me, bring me out of that.
No,
bring me back to it.
Hebrews 15 says, I have mercy on
whom
I have mercy, I have compassion
on whom I have compassion. That's right. And that's a great way to say it, but He is invested majorly in us, His Son, the life of His Son.
So here's the lesson. God has poured all of this investment into us that He's not going to forsake. What's the only wall? Of all these things, what is the only wall that can come between us and God? It's us. It's our doubt. It's our refusal to accept that. It's our refusal to have confidence that God will go with us. That is the one thing that can separate us.
Yeah.
None of these other externals can separate us. As a matter of fact, even our own dumb behavior can't separate us from the love of God. Somebody needs to honestly say amen to that. I know I don't say that a lot, but it's like...
Here's where we get worried and fearful also. I really believe I was following you, God. I heard from you clearly, God. I believe I was doing what you wanted me to do. And then you look at, well, how did I get here? Doesn't look like what it should look like right now. I thought I was being obedient. This whole thing doesn't look right, feel right.
And because you honestly believed that you were following me, I had mercy on you, and you did not perish. Because you honestly believed that you were following me. It turns out that you just missed me. But you know what? I'll bring you back around. Don't panic. Don't panic. What happens is people, human beings in general, are panicky, fearful, timid. I can't live without cable.
Well,
I have to shut the cable off.
And in reality, it's not only what you said, that I thought I was following God, but really I wasn't, but he has mercy on me because I... Look at Jesus' life and pretend that Jesus wasn't Jesus for a moment. What would it feel like to be Jesus if you were a man and find yourself on the cross that day? I thought for the last 3 years of my life I was serving you, and this is where I end up. So we need to come to terms with the fact that, yes, this isn't...
Yeah. Jesus wasn't. You're right. The disciples were thinking.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. They were thinking that. They absolutely thought, this is it. We are done. Because they hadn't experienced blood, like Paul says, without the resurrection. We're all idiots.
So there is no connection. This is where we come back to that original verse. There is no connection between your tribulation and the love of God.
Or ability, or circumstance, any of that stuff.
So the love that God has for us is totally unconditioned on our performance, what we do or don't do, and we don't rest in that.
Even when I said you behaved your way into something, God still loves you even though you behaved your way into something. But He has laid down principles since the beginning of time that He has consequences for.
And
before, His consequences will be thorough. Thorough. Why? Because He's a good dad and He doesn't want you to do it again. You're going to remember this pain. You're going to remember this trial. You're going to remember this and not return to it. When did they go back out into the desert again?
ever. I'm not going out there ever again. I'm staying here. He promised me this, even to this day. No, this is ours.
All right, let me finish reading this, and then if we have any final comments, we can do that and then get wrapped up. No, in all things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us.
Amen.
For I am sure that neither death nor life, that just really personal, neither death, we think that is ultimate, right? God would allow this to come into my life, but here's what he's saying. Even this is not a proof that you don't have God's favor and God's love. Neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all of creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. So let me ask you something. If you really, really believe this, could you go on for another day?
That's right.
If you really believe that God was on your side, that God did literally care for you, could you go on another 5 minutes?
That's right.
And that's, don't give up 5 minutes before the miracle.
Jason.
I know he's on my side. My situation is my own self, though. Indulging in my own behavior, I'm on the conscience of God. At that moment, but now I feel like a sad dog running back. You know,
he who has begun a good work in you will be faithful to follow through to completion.
And there's